As America begins the celebration of its 250th birthday, Voice of Vashon and the Vashon Heritage Museum thought it would be appropriate to create our own recognition of this important milestone. Welcome to Vashon 250, a look back at what was happening in America 250 years ago and comparing it to what has happened over the past 250 years of American history, what is happening in our current political life, and how these ideals and events have been reflected in the history of our own Vashon Island. I'm John Flora, and I'm joined by my colleague, resident historian, Bruce Hallman.
Thanks, John. Our approach to Vashon 250 during this 250th year of the United States of America as an independent nation uses the Declaration of Independence as an aspirational mission statement, the Constitution as a working user's manual, and the events of the American Revolution as a guide to help us understand who we are as a nation, how we came to be who we are, and how Vashon Island fits into this larger narrative structure.
Today, we're looking at three violent incidents which reflect the growing frustrations of the American colonists with the repressive action of the British government to implement their tax revenue-generating actions, particularly the Townshend Acts, which we discussed last week. So we're going to look at March 6, 1770, the Boston Massacre, April 13 through 14, 1772, the Pine Tree Riot, and then June 9, 1772, the Gaspe Incident. And we'll begin with the Boston Massacre. The Boston Massacre was a deadly altercation between British soldiers and a Boston mob that occurred on March 5, 1770, when the Redcoats fired on colonists, killing five and wounding six others. It was the culmination of resentment by the Boston citizenry toward British troops that Parliament had deployed in 1768 to enforce the Townshend Acts of 1767. The incident on March 5th began when a small group of Bostonians started harassing a lone British guard guarding the Customs House. As an aside, the original Customs House is gone, and it was rebuilt after that, and then it was rebuilt again in the late 1800s. It's still there today, so if you go visit, you can see it. And it's a big building. When a crowd assembled and became more hostile, British reinforcements arrived on the scene to protect the sentry. The soldiers, under the command of Captain Thomas Preston, fired their muskets into the crowd. The first person killed was Crispus Attucks, an African-American who worked on the docks in Boston. In order to restore peace between the Redcoats and the colonists, Governor Thomas Hutchinson conducted an investigation, and the soldiers were tried in court. They were defended by Founding Father John Adams, and two of the soldiers were found guilty of manslaughter. In the years following the Boston Massacre, March 5th was observed as a holiday in Boston, and a memorial was held to commemorate the incident. When freedom finally came, that March 5th holiday was kind of merged into July 4th. So the monument's still there, but they observe it with our independence. The Boston Massacre is commonly referred to as the first bloodshed of the American Revolution, although a few weeks before, on February 22, 1770, 11-year-old Christian Sider was killed by customs official Ebenezer Richardson when a crowd had gathered at Richardson's house and threw stones, breaking windows and striking Richardson's wife. Sider is considered to be the first American killed in the American Revolution. Bruce, let's talk about the Pine Tree Riot.
Sure, the Pine Tree Riot, a few years later, was an act of resistance to British royal authority undertaken by American colonists in Ware, New Hampshire, April 14, 1772, placing it among the disputes between the Crown and the colonists that would ultimately culminate in the American Revolution. In 1722, under the broad arrow policy, became illegal to cut down white pine trees larger than 12 inches in diameter in New Hampshire. This was so that they could reserve those white pines for use as a Royal Navy mast. This law was not strictly enforced until 1766, when Governor John Winthrop began enforcing it. So typically, you know, laws are passed, but if they're not enforced, people begin to act as if they don't exist. And then when they are enforced, often become enraged. And that's what happened in this instance. So on April 13th, 1772, Sheriff Benjamin Whiting and Deputy John Quigley discovered a sawmill in Ware, New Hampshire, that was violating the law. They arrested the leader, Ebenezer Mudgett, and released him on bail. The next day, Mudgett and 20 men attacked the sheriff and the deputy at the Quimbley Inn, beating them nearly to death with large rods and sending them out of town on horseback. So, another instance where sort of British overreach, if you will, or British enforcement of laws contrary to common practice in the colonies comes into play. And then just a couple months later, we have the Gaspee affair.
The HMS Gaspee was a Royal Navy revenue schooner that enforced the navigation acts around Newport, Rhode Island in 1772. It ran aground in shallow water while chasing the packet boat Hannah on June 9th off Warwick, Rhode Island. Group of men led by Abraham Whipple and John Brown attacked, boarded, and burned the Gaspee to the waterline. The Gaspee had stopped and inspected the sloop Fortune on February 17, 1772, and seized 12 hogsheads of undeclared rum. Duddingston sent the Fortune and seized rum to Boston, believing that any seized items left in a Rhode Island port would be reclaimed by the colonists. This overreach of sending Fortune to Boston brought outrage within the Rhode Island colony because Duddingston and had taken it upon himself with the authority to determine where the trial should take place concerning this seizure, completely superseding the authority of Governor Wanton by doing so. Furthermore, it was a direct violation of the Rhode Island Royal Charter of 1663 to hold a trial outside of Rhode Island on an arrest that took place within the colony.
So what we have here are three violent acts, you know, in March 1770, and then in April and in June of 1772, that set the stage for events to come a few years later that led to Lexington Concord and the shot heard around the world that began the American Revolutionary War.
And as a side point, Bruce, this suggests that when our legislature or Congress review, or even cities and counties, review old laws that are on the books, and sometimes we laugh about them because they're so goofy, but that's really an important thing because laws sit. And if they're not enforced, then something like this could happen, although it doesn't happen much anymore. But the fact is you want to get that stuff off the books and become contemporary with the operations of your community.
You do, and also you want to, the other side of this is this sort of common practice. I mean, it may not be a law, but there's a sense of common practice, and we'll talk about that in a bit, but it's common practice in the United States for law enforcement to not wear masks, to wear badges, to wear identifications, and now to, in contemporary times, often to wear body cameras and to sort of identify themselves as who they are. And when that sort of normative practice is violated, people get upset. So it's not just legal, but it's also normative.
And part of what has been the tradition of our country. Okay, let's move ahead. There are numerous events over the following 250 years of American history that echo the violent resistance of these events. What are some of the most significant of these events?
Well, there are quite a few, but let me just pull out a couple that sort of resonate with these. So October 1859, John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. John Brown, sort of firebrand abolitionist, active in Kansas, in bloody Kansas prior to the Civil War, very interested in sort of fomenting a slave revolt in the South. And he took it upon himself with a small group to attack the armory at Harper's Ferry in Virginia along the Potomac River to begin a slave rebellion. And of course, it was a failure. But it sort of terrorized much of the South. because the South is always, during this time, was always living in fear of slave revolts, and we'll talk in future shows about other slave rebellions. But it's also a time in which John Brown becomes the first American citizen tried and executed for treason. So what you have is a sense of the kind of outrage that was building in the 1840s and 1850s over slavery, resulting in the same kinds of activities that you see in the 1770s against the British Crown. And these are directed at the American government and at American slaveholders in the case of John Brown. So another classic example of this is in April 12, 1861, when the state of South Carolina takes upon itself to fire on Fort Sumter, and which is often viewed as the beginning of the American Civil War. So what you have are rising tensions among the North, between the North and the South, rising tensions over whether or not slavery will continue to be an institution and protected under the Constitution and under the laws of the United States. Of course, leading up to that, you have the Dred Scott decision, which essentially enforces the concept of slavery by returning freed slaves or escaped slaves back to slavery in the South. And so what you have is this increasing tension developing between Northern states and Southern states over who will run this country. And if you're a reader of Heather Cox Richardson, she does a masterful job sort of portraying what that sort of Southern aristocracy saw as their role of being a special class, an aristocracy, if you will, being able to run the country as they liked in the face of a growing sort of Northern sentiment that put the faith of government in the hands of common people. And of course, ultimately, this results in, you know, South Carolina deciding to secede from the Union and doing so by firing on a federal fort that guarded the harbor at Charleston, South Carolina. So, you know, there are a number of cases as we go along of these kinds of resistance to overreach by the government. On the other hand, there's also instances where the government overreaches, and two of those are the December 29th, 1890 massacre at Wounded Knee, when over 300 Lakota men, women, and children were massacred by soldiers from the U.S. Army, basically the 7th Cavalry, which was the unit commanded by Custer and wiped out at the Battle of Little Bighorn. And so there was a lot of resentment against Lakota warriors. And the Wounded Knee incident was just an incident in which U.S. Army soldiers using Gatling guns or machine guns wiped out an entire population of Lakota people, women, children, and warriors. And then in 1914, you have what is known as the Ludlow Massacre, part of the Colorado Coldfield Wars. Basically, a very bitter struggle between coal companies and mining companies and the emerging, you know, miners' union that was trying to organize and asking for basically humane working conditions and ending child labor and sort of protecting workers from injury in the mines, and of course a strike called in 1914, and Ludlow basically was one of the sites being struck by the miners, and in response, the governor of Colorado calls out the National Guard, brings in a private army, basically a detective agency, and in the process, they massacre a group of 21 miners, mostly women and children, are killed as they set up machine guns around this Ludlow camp, and they basically wipe out the strikers. And so what you have here in the John Brown case and in the Fort Sumter case, you have sort of groups opposing government policy. And in the case of Wounded Knee and the Ludlow Massacre, you have government opposing, you know, individuals. And then, of course, in 1937, there's the Memorial Day Massacre, Chicago Steel Strike, in which the Chicago police surround a group of unarmed strikers during a steel strike, and they kill 10 unarmed protesters. So when you put this all together, and there's a lot more in American history, but these are just sort of some examples of where you have groups of individuals opposing government policies, and then you have government opposing individual protests, and taken together, what you have is a history in America of violent resistance and violent put down of protesters and of those protesting government actions. So it's a very interesting sort of set of parallels that brings us up to current time.
So in some of those, I'm going to guess the latter ones that involved coal and steel, the, I don't know if it'd be the robber barons necessarily, but the corporate interests had to be part of that. And I know there's background with Henry Ford getting involved in things like that.
Yeah, very much. Well, the Ludlow strike was mainly the Rockefellers. Yeah. The Rockefeller family was a major holding of the company that owned the Ludlow mine. And of course, it was the first time that sort of public relations were brought in by the Rockefeller family to sort of lower the impact and lower the sort of temperature of the rhetoric and try and basically reconstruct the sort of story of the family in a way to distance themselves from the Ludlow Massacre. So yeah, lots of
interesting times.
Exactly.
So Bruce, we see that our history is filled with these times. They seem to, even though there's things going on all the time, there seems to be like 100 years between some of these. But so there's a bit of a pattern. But we live in violent times right now. And let's talk about what some of the most significant events in the U.S. have been during the last, say, 5 or 6 years.
Well, you know, I think initially, again, there's been violence all through American history. You know, the civil rights movement is just replete with violent incidents. And I mean, you could go on and on. But, you know, particularly since about 2020, you know, 2019, 2020, you know, the sort of murder of George Floyd, the rise of the Black Lives Matter sort of movement, was a very significant sort of turning point, I think, in this sort of rhetoric and the reaction that we see today in the post-COVID. Interesting to think, you know, most of that George Floyd sort of protest took place just before COVID or just at the beginning of COVID. And then COVID kind of shut it down. Mm-hmm. And we were in kind of a hiatus for a year and a half, almost 2 years. And then it comes back. And when it comes back, I think it comes back with a vengeance, if you will, in the sense that people are very upset with what's going on in American politics right now.
Well, and then if we look at the January 6th insurrection, taking of the Capitol, that's unprecedented. And to see that kind of thing happen and encouraged by many people is really troubling. And I shake my head at that when I see people beating up the Capitol and then tearing up the building inside. There's just no reason for that. It served no purpose whatsoever. And then they let them all go.
Well, but also take it back to where we started this program, talking about the Boston Massacre. And in many ways, many of those folks in the January 6th insurrection saw themselves as essentially, you know, the colonists in the Boston Massacre. They were protesting what they saw as a steal of American electoral politics. Whether or not that was true, of course, all the evidence indicates that there was no abnormalities in the election. But what you see in January 6, 2021, is a whole group of individuals who have convinced themselves and been convinced by the rhetoric of the time that indeed the American electoral system is broken, that American elections can't be trusted, and that they need to take to the streets, they need to attack the Capitol, they need to attack the police protecting the Capitol to ensure that their government is not taken over by nefarious forces. And so it becomes this sort of disconnect between the reality of what's going on and the rhetoric of what's going on. And January 6th becomes a prime example of the divisions that we've reached in our society right now.
Well, and I look at that and think to myself, I'm a big fan of having to go to the polling place and vote, partly because I like to see everybody. And there was something about that action that suggested I'm part of the country, I'm part of the deal. Filling out the form and dropping it in the mailbox is not the same. My opinion, you can disagree, whatever. But the question for me is, if people don't like that method, are they willing to do the work to change it back? And I don't think they are. You can go wave a flag or beat on a building or whatever, but if you don't really like it, are you willing to do the work? And I don't think they are. And that's a problem.
And so you've got the January 6th, 2021 sort of insurrection at the Capitol. And then jump forward to our current time right now in 2025, 2026, and particularly what's going on in Minneapolis, Minnesota right now with ICE raids and sort of the resistance by citizens and the resistance by ICE to citizens' protests. And you get at the heart of what the American Revolution was all about. You get to the heart of what the Boston Massacre was all about. And it's the role of the police, it's the role of ICE, and it's the role of public citizens in terms of how do you protest and how do you voice your opposition to government action. And as a government, how do you enforce the policies that you're pursuing? And Minnesota becomes a classic tension point, just like the Boston Massacre was a tension point.
It's one of those times when, as we say, history doesn't repeat itself, it rhymes with itself. But I look at this and think we have three branches of government that by design have their roles, they're supposed to work together. And when they work together, it works really well. But now we have this kind of thing where they're not. It's all disjointed. And how do you reel that back in? And that's a tough order. It'll be interesting to see how this all shakes out. Just over the week, this most recent weekend, it was announced that the city of Seattle has to pay $30 million to the family of who lost a teenager in the CHOP zone in downtown Seattle in 2020. Nobody came to serve him. Cops couldn't get in. The fire people couldn't get in. And so they couldn't get service to him. And we had a city council in Seattle at that time that was encouraging this activity. But then here's a life lost, and now the city has to pay the bill. That's a whole equal part of this thing. And you shake your head. And fortunately, most of those city council members are gone. Whether their replacement players will follow that model, or what we've had in more recent years of something a little more civil, who knows? But we've got a lot of work to do, and you just look at these examples and you shake your head and kind of it gives me cause for concern, and I really wonder how the next election will change that. So let's jump ahead to the island, our lovely Vashon. Mm-hmm. What are some Vashon events that echo these? I mean, we haven't had violence here on the island much, not like that, not like some of these that we've talked about. But, we've had the Pitchfork Brigade, and we've had other things like that. But what else?
Well, we have, and we've had violence on the island, not often in terms of what we think of, like the Boston Massacre, you know, or the January 6th insurrection. But, you know, you have to go back to 1854 and the Puget Sound Treaty War, and the territorial government basically rounding up all of the Shwabops, or native people of Vashon Island, moving them off the island to Fox Island, basically to a prison camp on Fox Island, all in the name of protecting them from settlers. You know, the Puget Sound Treaty War was the result of the Medicine Creek Treaty in this part of Puget Sound and the Point No Point Treaty in the northern part of Puget Sound, and native sort of reaction to the loss of territory and land and traditional rights. And so in that sort of treaty war, the territorial government decided it was easiest to protect, quote unquote, the native population by moving them into what in effect were concentration camps. And so in November 1854, the territorial government rounds up all the native people in central Puget Sound, move most of them to Fox Island. And if you know anything about November in Puget Sound, it's not exactly, prime time to be moving. And it's not a time to leave behind all the resources that you had developed in the past. And so what happened is you had huge amounts of death and illness in this concentration camp. Because they were moved out in the middle of winter without the supplies that they had traditionally built up over the summer. Another instance on Vashon, also violent in the sense that even though no one was killed, you had armed soldiers come to the island in May of 1942, May 16th, to round up the Japanese-American population, gather them at Ober Park, put them into trucks, drive them to a special ferry that took them into Seattle, put them on a train, and sent them off to World War II concentration camps for almost 5 years. And so we have on Vashon had some instances of these kinds of conflicts, perhaps not resulting in shootings and death in the same way that you get with the Boston Massacre, but certainly reflecting that. And then, of course, you have other sort of concerns on the island. We've talked in the past about the Memorial Day concert at the Jesus Barn in 1970 and how many islanders wanted to form an armed sheriff auxiliary to protect the island from this invasion of hippies. They saw another Woodstock sort of happening on Vashon Island. And then in 1992, very peaceful, but, basically, almost a third of the island turns out to protest the Washington State Department of Transportation plans to build a bridge to Vashon Island. And they made it very clear that Vashon did not want a bridge. Bridges bring death.
It's amazing when you look at some of that history. A couple things before we end. I had a good friend here visit over the weekend, and we went over to the Mukai home and barreling plant and looked at all the panels there. He had no idea. He's lived here a good part of his life, had no idea that the Japanese got kicked off the island and put into internment camps. Those kinds of things are, you got to know about. So when you travel, make sure you look around and see what's going on. And that concludes this week's episode. Bruce and I invite you to join us each week for interesting stories about our collective American and Vashon Island heritage. And our programs are available on the Voice of Vashon website at voiceofvashon.org. Go to the site and click on your choice of saved programs. If you have a question, comment, or suggestions of a topic, please drop us a note to Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. That's Vashon250 at voiceofvashon.org. Vashon 250 is a presentation of Voice of Vashon, your island connection. The show is produced by Truman O'Brien. Vashon 250 is sponsored by NACM Business Credit Services, a 126-year-old association focused on credit education and professional financial services. NACM serves business, credit, and finance departments across the Fruited Plain. We appreciate their support. And with that, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.